Lecture 5, Westward, the New Stone Age.
Now let's talk about Neolithic culture moving westward from its West Asian homeland. This lecture deals with the exportability of Southwest Asian Neolithic culture, its diaspora, as it's been called, which reached the shores of the Atlantic Ocean by the late 5th millennium. Three groups of case studies, or two case studies and one group study, I want to bring up in the course of this lecture. The first of them, the Chirokitian culture of the 6th millennium, is an example of maritime colonization. People had to sail from Anatolia to Cyprus. And also, sort of like the Jericho culture, of selective progress, very selective progress. Stone architecture was the most durable and impressive Chirokitian achievement. I don't mean durable in influence, because it seems to have been forgotten, but certainly durable to, as the archaeologist excavates it now. Neolithic cultures deriving from the southwest range of technology spread slowly northwestward also across continental Europe, from the Balkans to the valleys of the Danube and Rhine rivers to the Paris Basin, where they settled down with particular intensity between the 7th and the 5th millennia BCE. The most striking common features of these several Danubian cultures were long thatch-roofed wooden houses and sizable cattle herds attached to their villages. Other cultures of the same shared lineage developed very different lifestyles as Neolithic farmers adapted to the favorable environment of the Mediterranean basin. A striking instance of one of the religions developed by these Mediterranean cultures, the very diverse and varied Mediterranean cultures, is the burial site found in the Cave of the Bats, the Cueva de los Murciélagos, in southeastern Spain. The capacity of the Neolithic cultures of the Western variety to spread so widely was due at least partly to their flexibility and adaptability to diverse environments, which ended up creating culture after culture after culture. Neolithic culture proved to be as exportable as it was variable. Variety is not necessarily exportable, but in the case of the Southwest Asian Neolithic Revolution, it certainly was. Within 4,000 years of its emergence in the Southwest Asian homelands, it had reached the shores of the Atlantic Ocean, the outer limit imposed by geography until the 15th century of our era, when later Westerners learned how to navigate the oceans of the world and spread their culture across it, across them. One early phase of expansion by sea, of a seaborne diaspora, produced the Chirokitian culture, which spread across the Mediterranean island of Cyprus in the first half of the 6th millennium BCE and lasted for just under 1,000 years. The long duration of these Neolithic cultures and of their chieftain lineages and so on is really quite striking. The Chirokitians clearly sailed across the Mediterranean from the north, from Anatolia. And they moved across the island of Cyprus and settled down on the south coast, although the culture eventually spread throughout most of the island. All the skeleta found so far at Chirokitia are entirely brachycephalic in type, suggesting a racial type today called Alpine, very close to the 40% minority at Çatalhöyük. In the early 5th millennium, another culture coming from Syria to the east arrived in the island and began to displace the Chirokitian culture, which then faded away from memory. The settlers from Anatolia to the Chirokitians, in other words, brought with them the standard grains of Southwest Asian agriculture, none of which were native to the island. For meat, they hunted the native fallow deer, and either hunted or domesticated varieties of sheep, goat, and pig, very close in type to the wild ancestors of those breeds. Wild goats were native to Cyprus, but not wild sheep or wild pigs. Perhaps the Chirokitians brought those barely domesticated forms of livestock with them from the continent and either let them run wild or did not bother to domesticate them thoroughly in their new island home. It's hard to tell whether a given pig bone is from a wild pig or a feral pig, a domesticated form that's been allowed to run wild before tremendous amounts of selective breeding have produced really a different looking animal. In several respects, the Chirokitians were resolutely primitive. Some very crude pottery shows up in the lowest layer of Chirokitia, established by the first settlers. But their successors abandoned pottery. They also preferred chipped flint tools to the polished stone implements, which are normal indicators of the Neolithic culture, which are normal to all of the Neolithic cultures. At the same time, their contemporaries on the mainland, the people of Çatalhöyük, for example, who seem to have belonged partly to the very same racial stock as the Kirikitians, had thoroughly developed ceramic cultures. It looks as though these early settlers of Cyprus consciously rejected parts of their Neolithic legacy in favor of a simpler life. I think of California commune founders in the 1960s and 70s, for example, who had available in the whole range of Western culture and chose only some of it, usually the simpler forms, to build their own communities by. Wonder what archaeologists will make of some of those communes 1,000 years from now. In one respect, at least, architecture, the people of Kirikitia advanced far beyond their mainland contemporaries. They have nothing like the magnificent sculptures, small but magnificent sculptures, small but monumental and character sculptures of the women of Çatalhöyük. But they have remarkable houses, far beyond anything on the Asian continent at that point. The 1,000 houses of their town, which was certainly no mere village, whether you want to call it a city or not is a problem, but you certainly can't call it a village. 1,000 houses is much more than in the medieval Europe. That would have meant something much bigger than a village. They're not unlike the earliest houses at Jericho. Now, many archaeologists assume that this suggests traditional, if you want, kind of backward society. There's the assumption that a round house is derived from a hunter's tent or a sort of leather or skin-covered hut. I'm not so sure about this myself, but it seems to be a very wide assumption among archaeologists. When you find round houses, this is a sign of only gradual transition from Mesolithic habits, say. They're not going Neolithic whole hog. That at least is the general doctrine of the moment, which I pass on to you, not being an archaeologist or anthropologist myself. Backward as this may appear, if we accept, as I guess we should, this assumption, the houses of Kirikitia were ingeniously built. Now, by that time, by the time the Kirikitia is being built, Jericho had more rectangular houses than it had round houses. Remember, first of all, they were round, then they got rectangular, then they decided to do both. But the rectangular houses were more frequent in later levels of Jericho than the round ones. And even by the late 5th millennium, that's true at Jericho. The houses of Kirikitia were dome-shaped. Sometimes they're called beehive domes. They look more like eggs to me, remarkably regular egg-shaped domes, very high, highly pointed domes. The builders used three materials. The primitive pisae that Jarmo was largely built of, sophisticated mud bricks, as good as anything at Jericho or Çatalhöyük, and a local limestone, skillfully cut and laid, far better than the masonry of any of these places we've been talking about. These houses seem to have been coated with a type of plaster or whitewash and must have gleamed white in the sun and been quite beautiful. One thinks of traditional Mediterranean houses as being covered with coats of whitewash, Greek, Syrian, Arabic, whatever. And this was certainly part of that same aesthetic. The houses varied in size. Their diameters range from 4 yards to 10 yards. So not a bad-sized house, actually, if you measure it out. Just underneath the floor, the ancestors were curled up in fetal position, and they were buried with rich grave goods beneath the stone-paved floor. So you have, first of all, an invisible layer of ancestors, not as in Çatalhöyük, right under the bed, scattered, but throughout the entire floor. And they are covered by a floor of very handsomely laid flagstones, I guess you'd call them. These people were remarkable stonemasons. Where they developed this talent is unclear, but it's the great artistic achievement of the Kirikitian diaspora culture. To judge from these graves, men and women enjoyed equal status. The males are not any more favored than the females are, and that's an interesting kind of thing. No one has yet developed a guess as to whether Kirikitia was matriarchal or patriarchal or both or either, but this would be important evidence for anyone wanting to make such speculations. The living Kirikitians worked on those floors and in enclosed courtyards outside, or sometimes around these egg-shaped houses, there'd be something a little bit like a carport, so to speak, a covered carport. Although, of course, not for vehicles. They didn't have vehicles. They didn't have horses. Didn't have wheels. Anything of that sort. But there would be these low, sort of shed-like structures, sometimes going halfway around one of these egg-shaped houses, in which obviously various kinds of craft were practiced. And then there'd be courtyards without any roof, enclosed but unroofed. The people themselves would slept on lofts beneath the domed roofs, raised well above the floor, well protected from the damp, from the casual intruder, perhaps from the ghosts of the ancestors, whom one revered but did not perhaps want to have, you know, impinging quite as closely upon one's life as was the case at Chatal Huyuk. Now, the most striking and mysterious feature of the village of Khirokitia, which has given its name to this whole island-wide culture, was a raised stone avenue 600 yards long, 6 football fields, slicing through that large site, which was half a mile in diameter. This is quite a striking settlement, and it has this strange avenue, elevated. Elevated up to human rib or shoulder height, at different parts of it. We wonder what its function could possibly have been. Obviously, it wasn't important for transportation. I mean, people, we assume, walked along it, but only along that one street. Could its function have been to divide the town into two roughly equal groups of about 500 beehive houses each? If so, that would be very interesting. One wonders if these were two different marriage groups that you had to marry to someone from the other side of the avenue or something of that sort. Or was it designed to serve as a ceremonial thoroughfare? One made processions up and down it in honor of this or that divinity or season or clan or whatever it might be. Or could its purpose have been, frankly, many architects and builders guess, simply to give the people an outlet for their creative impulses? To give this artistically minded stoneworking community an outlet for their interesting and peculiar talents. The Khirokitians did import obsidian from Anatolia, but otherwise seemed to have preferred an isolated existence. In fact, one of the striking things about the obsidian tools, which were either imported into Cyprus or fashioned in Cyprus from sort of blocks of obsidian, is that they tend to be much less decorative, much less ritual, much less sophisticated than those which are normal on the Anatolian mainland. They tend to be simply practical. They're little cutting edges which are used for harvesting, or were used, we assume, for harvesting or for such things. The racial homogeneity of all the skeleta found so far is most unusual. Remember, this is a community that lasted for nearly 1,000 years. And there's very little variation. Perhaps they were weakened by excessive inbreeding by the time the new settlers from the Asian mainland arrived from the east. We don't know. We can get very precise statistics about their stature, for example. The average adult male stood 5'3" tall, and there's not much variation either beneath or above that. And the average adult female, 4'11". So they were shorter than the people of Chatal Huyuk, to some of whom they were related. They lived much longer, however. 33 years and 6 months on the average for women. We can get this precise, you see, because the skeleta are so close in type, that we can get kind of interesting central cluster skeleta. 33 years and 6 months on the average for women, 35 years and 2 months on the average for men, which were long lives for our Neolithic forebears. One thing we have to remember, which shocks much of the inherited information that we get from the usual textbooks, is that as far as we can tell from the example of the surviving hunting-gathering societies, hunter-gatherers live a lot longer than Neolithic villagers. Now, the hunting-gathering societies that were represented the lifestyle of the human race for, 90% of its existence, changed about 40,000 BC. There was a major change from simple balanced hunting-gathering to highly specialized hunting societies. And these were, for example, the societies of the Paleolithic cave painters, who painted the magnificent hunting art on the interior of the caves of central and southern France and northern Spain. Hunting, at least, is thought to be one of its possible purposes. These people did not live very long either. Most of them died around 35 and so on. They were fertile very early. Maturity came quite early, to judge from the 100 or so skeleta of Cro-Magnon men and women that we have available to us. But about 15 or so men and women were both mature, but by 35 most were dead. Why? One of the reasons could be the remarkably rich diet of fat meat that the specialized hunting culture brought in those conditions. However, after the glaciers pulled further north and the flora and the fauna all changed, you had what appears to be, in Europe and Asia, a reversion to an earlier kind of much more balanced hunter-gatherer society. You have reversion in what was called the Mesolithic period. Now, we have very little in the way of skeletal information from the Mesolithic period. But to judge by analogy from the existing hunter-gatherer societies, the guess would be that lifespans extended in the Mesolithic period, although height and strength and so on declined. Now, along comes the Neolithic lifestyle, and with the Neolithic lifestyle, lots of changes occur. What you get is shortened lifespans again, though. It looks as though early Neolithic people, or fully developed Neolithic cultures, had shorter lifespans than the Mesolithic hunting-gathering cultures from which they evolved. This is sort of the opposite of what we tend to expect. We've also pointed out in the last lecture that the early image of the strong hunter dominating this tribe, of this hunting-gathering tribe, is based simply on fantasy. There is no analogical evidence for it. We find instead the elders, male and female, settling conflict problems within the community, and we find with the emergence of chieftainship on the in the newer Neolithic societies. Now, these Kirikitians are very interesting. The fact that they have longer lives than their counterparts in Çatalhöyük may be a function of the fact that they were in many ways, they had re-mesolithed themselves, having available to them a pretty advanced form of Neolithic culture of the Çatalhöyük type from Anatolia. They decide on a simpler lifestyle. They regress in terms of tools. They regress in terms of food supply. And this may be a factor in their extended life. This is one of the curious kinds of data that comes up from the data we have available. We can't be certain because, of course, the hunting-gathering societies we know about are sort of champion hunting-gathering societies. The Inuit, the Eskimo, the Hottentot in Southwest Africa. They may have been healthier, had longer lifespans than the hunting-gathering societies of Europe and Asia from which the Neolithic cultures we're talking about evolved. In any event, Neolithic culture, even though it may have brought shortened lives, spread overland to the northwest into the heart of continental Europe. One of the most vigorous and far spread of these European pioneering cultures is now generally called Danubian. Actually, there's a whole series of Danubian cultures, stretching from the Balkans to northern France, from Bulgaria to the Paris Basin, which took about 2,500 years to get from Bulgaria to the Paris Basin. From about 6,500 to more something like 4,500 BCE, we have this very slow spread up the valley of the Danube and over to the valley of the Rhine and then across the plains of what is today northern France. By about 4,000 BCE, these cultures begin to give way to later cultures, to post-Danubian cultures as well. The term Danubian is a great can of worms and a great nest of difficulties, but it seems difficult to think of something else to describe this movement from the Neolithic homeland northwestward into colder, wetter Europe. Now, most archaeologists, certainly including Gordon Child, have seen this sequence of Neolithic cultures, this Danubian sequence, as the product of colonization. Colonization from southeastern Europe, deriving ultimately from the earlier Neolithic cultures of southwestern Asia. This is a classic case of Childian diffusionism. Diffusion by means of emigration, colonization, and so on. According to this view, migrating pioneer people, brought with them West Asian grains and animals, but adapted their houses to the new environment, which was much wetter and colder than in the Neolithic homelands. Around 5,500 BCE or so, sort of halfway in the course of this migration, the slow migration northwestward, these Danubians developed a type of longhouse built of wood with pitched roofs of thatch, which, with modifications, remained the basic European house for millennia long past the Neolithic era, and is still with us today. Certainly a standard 17th century rural house, the long hall. The Danubians were great cattle raisers as well as farmers. The dominant guess is that their social structures were patriarchal. In other words, What we have here is the basic type of European peasant society. Patriarchal, cattle raising, long thatch roof houses, all the rest of it. And the basic European peasant type is seen as a development of this Danubian culture's experience with the diaspora into challenging environments which pose certain difficulties and to which excellent adaptations were made. Now, recently, some archaeologists are disagreeing with this model. Outstanding among them is Alasdair Whittle of Cambridge, and other archaeologists, predominantly British archaeologists, interestingly enough, have challenged this line of analysis. Those of you who are Anglophiles will perhaps be surprised by this. Those who are Anglophobes will not be at all surprised that the British have decided that they weren't just migrants from the continent, that they are something else indeed. What Whittle argues is that agricultural technology, stock-raising technology, spread widely among many native, local hunting-gathering peoples who adopted them and adapted them and adapted themselves in the process. In other words, it may be that for people like Whittle, the cultures of Britain and northwestern France were native cultures. At least the human stock was native. The culture came in from elsewhere, but the people were their own kind. Now, aside from this sort of snide and irresponsible allusion of mine to Anglophobia and Anglophilia, the material evidence bears strong support to this thesis, especially the tremendous variety of ceramic styles. Some of these Danubian cultures don't vary so much. Their pottery doesn't vary that much as you sort of follow them up the Danube. But around any major place of settlement, a tremendous range of ceramic styles will arrive. And this suggests, I think reasonably to archaeologists, that you have local people picking up this alien technology and adapting it. But they express their locality in the tremendous diversity of ceramic styles. That's one of the reasons why ceramics are so important in the discussion of any of these topics. In any case, the longhouses and farmyards, which we can reconstruct from certain well-documented sites, there are several in central Hungary, for example, from sort of that middle period of this Danubian movement from Bulgaria to Paris. These longhouses and the farmyards around them tell us a lot about European Neolithic life from the 5th millennium onward. These houses are quite long, and some of them have practically a second story, or a kind of beginning of a second story. There will be a second mezzanine or something of this sort, a kind of a gallery which is set up. Could this be for people to sleep in, like the Kyrakhetians? Could possibly. Or would it be used for storage? A place to put hay, for example. Of course, to put hay underneath a thatch roof is inviting fire. But there's less danger from fire in the wet lands of Europe than in the extremely dry land of Çatalhöyük, where fire could happen all the time. And those people made some effort to have well-sealed masonry roofs, which would prevent the spread of fire. Some of these houses were simply for humans, with animals kept in either corrals or almost barn-like buildings outside. Some of them, however, clearly have space for bringing the animals under the same roof. And one might want to do that, at least for select animals, favorite cows in full milking, for example, perhaps a bull or two was a breeding animal, whatever. And one of the advantages that occurred to people who did this was that living with the animals, a partition, of course, between the human part of the house and the animal part of the house, but not too severe a partition, living with the animals in this kind of arrangement was tremendous for solving the heating problem. The animals generated a great deal of heat and helped to warm the entire household in a period where winters are something that you really have to think about. Europe was warmer in those days than now, but not that much warmer. You can imagine what life within such a Danubian house would have been like olfactorily, at any rate. Everybody would have smelt significantly of wood smoke and animal perfume, especially the rich contributions that the animals would make to agriculture. Actually, people do not seem to have been aware of the value of manure as a fertilizer until the Iron Age. Although some of these Danubians may have been conscious of that as well. We don't find evidence of great manure piles outside the houses, which were considered in Iron Age and medieval and early modern society one of the great signs of peasant wealth. a peasant who had a huge manure pile, often up against the house to warm it, because of the kind of oxidation that goes on within a manure pile, were often seen by visiting aristocrats or visiting urbanites as being desperately poor people. How tragic, whereas the peasant involved was very proud of his tremendous manure pile up against the wall. We don't see that around the Danubian houses. And that's one of the signs that they have not yet learned about the fertilizing effect of this byproduct of animal life. An unfortunate dimension of this closeness to domesticated animals is the story of human disease. Many of our worst diseases are the adaptations into the human body of diseases of pigs, dogs, cows, and so on, which we see apparently no sign of in the medical anthropological work on hunting-gathering peoples, but we do see them once you begin not just to domesticate the animals, but to live with them, which is something that this European style of diaspora Neolithic life began to do in a serious way. The agricultural or Neolithic revolution, whichever you prefer to call it, also spread westward along the Mediterranean coastline, producing a tremendously wide range of cultural diversity. And here is where the Whittle-type thesis of the technology coming in to one new people after another makes an awful lot of sense. Typical of Mediterranean geography is the type of narrow coastal plain between the mountains and the sea, which is known as a riviera. We speak of the French Riviera and the Italian Riviera, but the entire Mediterranean basin, Spain, Italy, what used to be called Yugoslavia, Greece, North Africa, etc., is made up of rivieras. The mountains come close to the sea, and there's this kind of short shelf, which is watered by whatever water the mountains can give you in springtime, and tends to be pretty rich soil as well. And all kinds of communication and trade is possible along the coastlines of this kind of geography. It's an ideal environment for early agriculture. Which came, before 6000 BC, certainly. There's something called the cardiac, the cardial culture, not cardiac, which is named from the kind of pottery developed in various parts of the Mediterranean coastline, decorated by cardium shells, a certain kind of seashell that is pressed into the wet clay. So these cardial cultures are one type. There are many, many different ones. By about 4300 BCE, an interesting date when we get to concentrate on the British Isles, which is the central focus of this course, by 4300 BCE, Neolithic cultures were spreading inland from the Rivieras, from the Mediterranean coastal Rivieras, up to the relatively high mountain ranges and the upland, the tableland of central Spain, which is known as the Meseta, the tableland of the Iberian Peninsula. These early Spanish Neolithic cultures seem to have been typically matriarchal. They used ceramic vessels along with strongly woven baskets and fashioned some very elegant jewelry from gold, as well as from bone and seashells, which are often traded at considerable distances from the coast. In the benign environment of the Rivieras, durable houses were of little use, so we have little sense of their dwellings. If you live in the northern Europe, you better make a pretty solid house. You don't have to make a very solid house in Cyprus, but the Hyrcanians wanted to. These Mediterranean, long string of Mediterranean cultures were not much interested in that. They frequently used caves, sometimes as residences, regressing, if you want, to one of the patterns of Paleolithic life, and certainly as centers of ritual cult. One of the most eloquent of these cave sites is the Cueva de los Murciélagos, the Cave of the Bats in the province of Granada in the mountains of southeastern Spain. It is a burial site, clearly matriarchal in character. In 1831, a Spanish gentleman antiquarian and his manservant were digging into this cave, and they dug through, rocks and rubble and so on, and they came upon the central space and were jolted because they saw sitting up a skeleton, a tallish skeleton, which later analyzed by the local doctor, proved to be the skeleton of a woman, around whom were more than a dozen skeleta wrapped up in baskets of very fine straw work, about a dozen members of the community, men, women, adults, children. These were, by the way, not noticed the first time. The antiquarian was so struck, amazed, horrified by the sight that they did not notice the other people buried there. Later visits found the other people buried there. Unfortunately, a lot of this was done by enthusiastic but very amateur gentlemen archaeologists, so the precise information isn't terribly clear. But the lady wears a gold diadem, very elegant, could be very contemporary, expensive jewelry. And the sandals, baskets, and hats of straw there show the very high level of the Spartero, the Espartero weavers, of the straw weaver's craft. The sandals and the skeleton of that burial show us also the physical character of that long-headed, short-statured Mediterranean population. We don't have enough skeleta from this particular community to get a sense of average age at death, because those surrounded in their baskets, buried, so to speak, around this lady, were of all ages and of all and of both genders.
Lecture 6, The Windmill Hill Culture.
This lecture anchors the second half of this course firmly in the southern part of Great Britain, with the beginning of a detailed presentation of the Windmill Hill Culture, with the first fully developed and widely influential Neolithic culture in that island. It flourished between, well, two classic dates of 4340 BCE and 2250 BCE, both of them deriving from long barrows, so we'll go into that in considerably greater detail. Before presenting that culture, this lecture, Fani explores at some length the term culture, especially as defined and adumbrated by the British archaeologists Gordon Child and Paul Ashby. We'll then turn to the basic facts about the Windmill Hill people and to their culture's three distinctive monuments: the Long Barrow, a collective burial ground; the so-called Causewayed Camps, a misnomer based on earlier antiquarians' assumption that these were highly military people; and the Henges, complex monuments to be defined and explored in later lectures. We've been using the term culture quite freely in this course so far. Now it's time to define it. Gordon Child provided a list of the elements necessary to defining a culture. I won't go through it in minute detail, but try to summarize it by saying that these include dwellings, cult buildings, burials, non-utilitarian objects. By non-utilitarian objects, Child included ornaments, cult objects, what we eventually would be called art, utilitarian objects, that is, tools, food-producing techniques, weapons, and socio-political structures. Now, this last one, socio-political structures, is last in the list, not because it's the vaguest of them all, the least scientific, the least definable by material archaeology, but because, in Child's mind, it culminates all the rest of them and represents the kind of final cap. We can get a very clear idea of the socio-political structures of contemporary cultures that we study as archaeologists, or that we live in, or of historically attested cultures. But Neolithic cultures, that's quite a problem. Now, to Child's list of particulars, we should add, I think, a definition of the mental and territorial elements of a culture, which, of course, have a lot to do with social and political structures. But they're somewhat different. They overlap in interesting ways. Paul Ashby provides an effective, if dense, statement of something which he calls community, which touches this very question. Ashby says, "Any consideration of the mechanics of change in early society must take cognizance of the intangibles that lie behind material expression. A community living on a tract of land, a territory, is a coherent entity which is an organism made up of people, just as the human body is made up of cells." So far, so good. "Unlike the human body, however," Ashby continues, "the people who comprise a particular community are not bound together physically. They are linked by far firmer, flexible bonds, those of the mind. These mental bonds, of which funerary usages and fashions of material culture may be only distantly indicative, are the attitudes, beliefs, conceptions, ideas, and notions shared by, and thus because of social stratification, only common to, in a relative manner, all the members of every human community." This is a wonderful example of contemporary archaeological prose, and is one reason why Gordon Child remains, even though he's so outdated, so much more readable than the more carefully, the almost painfully careful definition, which I think is a brilliant one, though, that Ashby provides us with. Keeping these specifications in mind, let's turn now to the first fully developed Neolithic culture in south-central Great Britain, which modern archaeologists have named the Windmill Hill Culture. It will be followed in the kind of material we're talking about in this course by something called the Wessex Culture, which can be seen either as a radically different culture replacing the Windmill Hill Culture, the older view, or in the more contemporary view, as a continuation, a kind of Bronze Age, second stage development of the Windmill Hill Culture. In that case, you would want to track this early South British culture not only from 4340 plus or minus BCE to 2250 plus or minus BCE, but bring it all the way up to something like 1350 BCE. We're talking now about two cultures, or two halves of one culture, following in sequence over a period of only something like three millennia. Nothing, a mere piker, compared with the incredible durability of the Jericho culture, for example, or even that of Çatalhöyük. Now, whether or not this Windmill Hill culture represents the first arrival of agriculture in Great Britain, as many think it does, it was certainly the first fully elaborated such culture, and seems to have influenced to some degree all later British Neolithic cultures, and perhaps even some of those of Ireland. Its earliest monument identified so far is the Lambourne Long Barrow in Berkshire, which is dated by the carbon 14 method to 4340 BCE plus or minus. This is a calibrated carbon 14 figure in which the carbon 14 date has been checked out against the calibrations from certain kinds of trees, and it seems to be fairly secure. 4340 BCE. By 3700 plus or minus, which is the date of the first layer of another long barrow, the long barrow known as the Middle Ages as Wayland's Smithy, which overlooks the Upper Thames Valley, this Neolithic culture had spread widely across what are now the counties of Hampshire, Wiltshire, Dorset, Berkshire, and Oxfordshire, south central England, in other words. How long did the Windmill Hill culture last? There's no clear date, no clean break. Instead, we can discern a transitional fade out starting around 2200 BCE, so it lasted roughly for two millennia, surviving by about 1,000 years, the climatic optimum in which it had arisen. The climatic optimum gets going around 5500 and ends about 3200. The Windmill Hill culture has begun in it and will last at about another 1,000 years, simply in its pure form. Not talking about its transmuted extension into this thing called the Wessex culture. That'll last on until about 1350 BCE. There's no agreement among archaeologists at the moment as to the sources or origins of the Windmill Hill culture or of their people. Was that way of life brought to Britain by immigrants from the continent, as Child assumed? The British Isles had been separated from the continent since 7600 BCE, but you don't need much in the way of boat technology to cross the channel, especially one of its narrower points, and then to coast along the coast until you reach an acceptable place to enter. Or was the Windmill Hill culture the creation of native hunter-gatherers who acquired and adapted to their particular environment the agricultural technology that had been spreading westward across Europe for the previous two millennia, as Whittle has argued for many continental Neolithic cultures? I think it's a little bit harder to imagine simply adapting the grains and the animals and the pottery and so on and applying them to your own country when you're dealing with an island. This kind of movement could occur quite easily across the vast stretches of the European continent. But if you're going to bring a whole way of life across even something as narrow as the English Channel, it seems to me that here the immigrant probability tends to be a little bit more likely. Maybe the Windmill Hill culture was the result of a fusion of these two patterns, immigrants meeting adaptive locals. And that may account best for the uncommonly creative character of southern Britain's first major Neolithic culture. Now, this Windmill Hill culture of the late 5th millennium BCE arose in an attractive and encouraging environmental landscape. Well-drained uplands from 500 to 1,000 feet above sea level, of chalky soil known today as the Downs. We should remember that in English geographical terminology, the Downs are uplands. You have to go up to the Downs from places like Oxford or Bristol or Salisbury. And these downs, whose name derives not from an Anglo-Saxon word having to do with being a place that is lower than some other place, but from the Celtic word dun, which means a settlement, often a fortified settlement, because the Saxons, when they came into the island, knew that the Britons hung out on those uplands in refortified hill forts. These downs were then covered by a light forest of alder and hazel and oak trees. Today they are bare, but at that time they were heavily forested. And these factors made for a thin but rich topsoil, which was initially very receptive to the agriculture and to the pastoral technology of that phase of the European Neolithic. The fact that this was a forest rising from a base of chalk has several important consequences. For one thing, such soil drains beautifully, which means that certain kinds of grains can grow very well upon it. It means, however, that trees cannot sink their roots very deeply, even though oak trees, for example, were widespread in the Downs. Oaks are not, as you know, very deep-rooted trees. Their roots tend to spread out. They're very strong roots, but they're widespread in that regard. It was, in other words, a fragile environment, and it would soon prove its fragility in some interesting ways. In the climate of the 13 centuries between 5500 and 3200 BCE, the temperature was on the average 3 to 5 degrees Celsius warmer than today, significantly warmer than today. For much of that period, rainfall was less steady and the skies were clearer than now. Southern Britain resembled perhaps central Spain or northern Spain in from the coast a great deal more than it resembled the Britain of today in that regard. And that difference of 3 degrees Celsius, certainly 5 degrees Celsius, makes for a tremendous difference in building techniques and forming possibilities and so on. After several generations, the domesticated sheep and goats that came from the continent began the deforestation of the Downs. Sheep and goats, as I remarked already, love nothing better than the shoots of young trees. Anytime a young tree threatens to get going again on the Downs, if there are sheep and goats about, they'll get it. They had already, their forebears and relatives had done the work magnificently in the ancient Near East. Remember that the region around Jarmo and Çatalhöyük and all of that was a land of oak and pistachio forests on the slopes of not so much of mountain country exactly, sort of Piedmont country. Today it's bare, thanks very much to the domesticated animals of the Neolithic and subsequent pastoral cultures of that region. Since about 3500 BCE, as pollen analysis has shown us, the Downs of southern England, along with the moors of northern England, very much the same kind of landscape, and the bare uplands of much of the rest of the British Isles, have been denuded of their tree cover. These bare grasslands have been one of the most durable features of the British landscape, which, like landscapes everywhere, is a product of human culture rather than of nature. We now know that only in the Antarctic do we have what we could call an entirely natural landscape. It's been demonstrated that the selection of trees growing in the Amazon Valley has been very much affected by the small hunting-gathering societies which move through that territory, which discourage certain kinds of tree growth and encourage others. We may speak of the landscape, we've been long tradition of speaking of the landscape as the legacy of nature. It is not. It is the primary human cultural artifact. Now, three distinctive monuments characterize the Windmill Hill culture. Cult structures, cult buildings, I guess, Child would call them. Some of them are shared in some form with other Neolithic cultures deriving from the Southwest Asian agricultural revolution, but some are unique to Britain. Long barrows were the first monuments of this culture. And these long barrows don't have certain counterparts in continental Europe among some of the Danubian cultures in some of the territories of the various Danubian cultures, but the dissimilarities, it seems to me, are greater than the similarities. Here may be a case of a borrowed form, borrowed either by imitation or brought by immigrants from the continent. The second distinctive monument of the Windmill Hill culture is the Causewayed Camp, structures on the top of bare hills, misnamed Causewayed Camps, by early modern antiquarians rather than formal scholars. They were also produced by members of this culture, clearly after the Long Barrows. The Long Barrows are the first of the monuments of this culture, which the dating of which we begin with the Lamborn Long Barrow of 4340 BC. Next came the Causewayed Camps, and next came the best known and most impressive of the Windmill Hill culture's monuments, the henges, which are the most famous features of this culture. And the most famous of the henges of the Windmill Hill culture are at Avebury in Wiltshire and at Stonehenge, some 18 miles away in the same county. The dwellings of the Windmill Hill farmers have almost entirely eluded archaeology. In the sunny and moderately humid environment of the British climatic optimum, solidly built houses may have seemed unnecessary. And after the climatic optimum ends, about 3200, you begin to see more evidence of more solid houses. By about 2000, 1500, we are aware of log cabins, which these people are building. But earlier on, in the late 5th and the early and the 4th millennium BCE, solidly built houses were not one of the things they produced. It seems likely that farming families of this culture moved from one plot of cultivated land to another every few years across the territory of their particular area. And the reason for this was the chalklands. And the more the chalklands get deforested, the harder it gets to cultivate them, especially if you don't have a significant fertilization system going. And they do not seem to have been aware of the benign impact of manure in this regard. So that for 4 or 5 years, or 3 or 4 years, a family would farm a particular stretch of the downland, and then when the crops were already clearly less productive than in the previous year, they would move to another plot not too far away, and then to another and another, going perhaps around 5 or 6 plots in the course of the lifetime of a member of the Windmill Hill culture. So, why bother to build a house very solidly when you would have to be abandoning it fairly soon? Also, if you would not return to the plot of land you were doing at point A until perhaps 10 or 15 years later, any house you would have built would have been in pretty bad shape, and they were much more likely to start all over again. However, all over this landscape, we find typically Neolithic stone tools and handsome pottery, a kind of pottery that is very culture specific, very plain, tends to be dark, either darkish red or black sometimes, possibly from the smoking process, very plain, but I think very attractive in terms of modern aesthetic tastes. Why do we find these objects scattered over the landscape? They were left over or dumped as throwaways by the householders as they moved. We also find lots of skulls as well as other animal bones. And these animal bones are basically the product of the animals eaten by these people, which of course would be tossed outside the house after consumption and become a kind of a midden, a kind of a garbage pile, which would of course be left behind with even greater enthusiasm by the people when they moved. But we also have evidence of lots of skulls. It's very clear that the Windmill Hill people like to hang the skulls of animals they had slaughtered or that they had killed in the hunt. In the inside of their houses, a taste which has remained very strong in the great houses of Britain and even in more modest houses in British America. The physical type of the Windmill Hill farmers is clear from several hundred skeleta that have been found buried in the barrows and also elsewhere. The barrows are not the only places where people are buried, or at least individual bones can be found which can be assembled with a certain physical type. They were mostly short people, long-boned and long-headed, dolichocephalic people, in other words, who lived into their 30s if they were lucky. Their health was terrible thanks to malnutrition. I'll talk more about that when we take a look at what might have been responsible for raising the Great Henge of Avebury. These bone remains suggest, in other words, an undernourished Mediterranean racial type. We have no idea of their coloration, however. Some English artists today like to depict these ancient British as fair-skinned and light-haired, even red-haired. It seems more likely, though, that they shared the dark pigmentation of other Mediterranean populations. As one travels in Britain or Ireland today, one is constantly reminded of the black Welsh or the black Irish. And many a person has pointed out to me someone or standing in a British market or who or simply someone one meets at a party who is described as someone left over by the Roman legions or left over from the sailors of the Spanish Armada, the genetic contribution of these Mediterraneans to the British population. It's actually much more likely that the Black Welsh, the Black Irish, and the Black English represent the native British and Irish stock, which launched the first Neolithic cultures in these islands, rather than any genetic legacy of Roman occupiers or Spanish Armada sailors fleeing, swimming away from the wreckage of their fleet. I remember, however, a sort of awkward moment when I was beginning to get into this kind of material, was having dinner with some friends of ours. And the wife, whom I'd come to know fairly well, a distinguished musician, a daughter of a farming family of Wiltshire, not gentry exactly, but very solid farming family, seemed to me to have exactly the type of the skull type, the height, the general body type of the people who had built Avebury and Stonehenge. And I remarked this to her, thinking it would be a compliment. She was horrified and deeply offended, wanting to be descended from Saxons or somebody much more noble than that. Not so, didn't want to think that she was from those primitive people. Wonderful lack of appreciation of this remarkable foundation culture, which I think survives in the English, although certainly not in the Welsh mentality. The Welsh sort of like the idea that they represent the true Britons who've been driven back and up into the mountains by one after another wave of negative invasion. Let's take a look at these different monuments. First of all, the Long Barrows. They're found all over southern Britain, and they're still visible in the grasslands of the Downs, where sheep raising has been the basic economic activity for a very long time. It has been estimated that in the 18th century, there were 1 million sheep in the county of Wiltshire. Wiltshire, which is one of the least populated counties in human terms in all of England, I think it is the least populated English county per capita, had a very dense population of sheep. And of course, you do not disturb things like lumps in the earth if they're covered with nice grass and if it's basically useful for feeding your sheep. We now know, thanks to aerial photography, infrared photography, and rescue archaeology, that Long Barrows were constructed all over the low valley lands as well. But in subsequent periods, they got plowed over by later farmers and cannot be discerned except as crop marks in the soil or by aerial photography. Aerial photography spots an anomaly in the surface, and then the archaeologists go for it, and they find long barrows all over the place. The Windmill Hill long barrows are almost all quadrilateral polygons. They have four corners. Two of those corners are right-angle corners, and one is acute and one is obtuse. Look at any diagram of any of these long barrows. For example, the Wayland Smithy long barrow, which overlooks the River Thames from the crests of the Downs in what is now the county of Oxfordshire, will give a good example of this kind of construction. These barrows are usually 10 or more times as long as they are broad. The wider of the two short sides faces southeast in most instances, with some variation of orientation, but the great majority of the long barrows face southeast, or south of east, or, you know, east of south, or something of that sort, in the area between due east and due south. Some very few face due south, or closer to it. Some very few do due east, or nearly. A very few long barrows are oriented to the northeast, roughly the direction of midsummer sunrise. One of these is located west of the Avebury Henge, another is west of Stonehenge. None point due north or west. So the southeastward orientation of these is, I think, extremely compelling. Why? Well, one answer is this is the locus of sunrise during most of the year. During some of the year, of course, the sun rises north in the northeast around midsummer. But most of the time the sun rises to the southeast, and this has to do with life and rebirth. Others say this was the homeland. This points to the Neolithic homeland of West Asia. This is where the people knew they or their remote ancestors came from. And either hypothesis works, of course. Unfortunately, we cannot prove out either of them. We probably will never know the answer to this. Most of these long barrows were constructed of earth, chalk, and household rubbish piled in between rows of logs. The barrow, now known as the Fussell's Lodge Barrow in western Wiltshire, excavated by Ashby, was begun about 4,000 BCE, about three centuries or more after the Lambourne Long Barrow, once the people had been solidly settled into that part of the country. And it's been effectively reconstructed as a classic example. In the 4th millennium BCE, the Windmill Hill barrow builders began to face the sides of their barrows, especially that critical southeast side, with large stones called megaliths. A fine example is the West Kennet Long Barrow at Avebury in northern Wiltshire, the greatest of the long barrows of Britain. The second stage of Wayland Smithy on the Ridgeway Path, which was constructed about 3400 BCE, was faced on all sides with large stones drawn from the nearby downs, revetted by stones instead of by logs. What were the functions of these barrows? First of all, basically, they were for collective burials. In the southeastern and widest side, human skeleton were buried. A few selected individuals were buried there, sometimes within stone chambers, more often not. After the mid-4th century, the stone chambers became usual rather than exceptional. Now, it's important to recognize that less than a tenth of the length of these long barrows was actually used for burial. And the individuals buried in the burial chambers represent both sexes and all ages pretty evenly, almost as though a statistical sample was being chosen. An exceptionally high percentage of the skeleta buried in these barrows show signs of spina bifida, a disease of the spine, vertebrae, and spinal nervous column that seriously debilitates those afflicted with it. It's very difficult for such people to walk or to do any kind of work involving lower back muscles. Urinary control is minimal. The bladder is affected and so on. It's a very debilitating disease. It's found today almost entirely among people of British and Irish ancestry. Somewhat as sickle cell anemia is today limited mostly to those of West African descent. What can this mean? There are several theories. One notion is that sitting and doing something like learning the lore of the people is one of the things that spina bifida sufferers can do. They can't normally hunt or farm or do a variety of other things. What we might have here are the people who know the lore, the lore's learned in the lore of the people. They could be young, they could be old, they could be men, they could be women. Or then some suspect that congenital afflictions of this kind might have been seen as a sign of divine specialness, as is certainly the case in Eastern Europe, where having a certain kind of congenital disease means that you have been struck by God's hand, and people feel sorry for you, but they also recognize the kind of awe of a certain closeness to the divine, to the other world, the spirit world, that this gives. What does a range of ages in these burials suggest about the individuals chosen for burial there? Do they represent different sectors of the community? Were they the members of a chieftain family? Were they special cases, such as the spina bifida sufferers? Again, explanations differ widely. The long barrows may also have served as deposit shrines. Some of the material deposited between the rows of logs, or later on the stone revetments, is chalk dug from two parallel trenches that usually accompany these barrows. But that doesn't give you enough chalk to fill up the space. A small part of the barrow is dedicated to burials, but most of the rest of the material that is filled in between the logs or the stones consists of the sweepings of human residences, the short-term houses of these farming communities. What can this fact of our material archaeology tell us? Well, many of the older folk in Ireland and Britain today still believe that kitchen sweepings, including coffee grounds and broken pottery, make the best garden fertilizer. Could this be a durable legacy of the Windmill Hill culture? Could the use of such settlement refuse be a byproduct of the frequency with which these farming people moved from field to field around the easily depleted chalklands of their territories? Could this habit be a sign that each barrow served as the collective home fixed in location of all the ancestors of the community, each one of whose huts would have been swept out when he or she died? We don't know. We never shall. But it's wonderful to speculate. These long barrows almost certainly, however, did serve as the foci of individual agricultural communities of perhaps 125 to 200 living members, the equivalent of a small medieval village or of a larger jarmo. I say the living members. They were also the homes of the ancestors. The spirits of the ancestors lived along them. This seems to be fairly clear from the way they're represented in more modern folklore. The term causewayed camps was applied in the 19th century to sites on hilltops marked by one or more concentric broken circles of ditches. in which broken pottery, tools, and many cattle bones were buried apparently all at once. At Windmill Hill in Wiltshire, which gave its name to the whole culture, there are 2.5 such circles. One could imagine the undug spaces between the curving ditches as causeways breaking through the circles of broken defensive ditches. Relying on their imaginations more than on any excavation results, early antiquarians supposed that these were the sites of military encampments, in the ditched fortifications of which causeways were left undug so as not to impede the use of chariots against the enemy. But no excavation of any of these sites has yielded any evidence of any military activity. So this theory was entirely wrong, but the name has stuck despite its inaccuracy. What could their functions have been? The old military theory is obsolete. A later commercial theory seems more likely. Local trading seems to have taken place at these sites from time to time. Among the pottery is pottery from other places, jewelry, a little bit of tools. The most current theory sees these as the sites of group ritual activity. It seems most likely that large numbers of people would come together on these hilltops at fairly regular intervals, let's say every 10 years, for ceremonies or other types of meetings, which involve feasting on beef, drinking from, and then breaking pots, some of which may have carried grain or other kinds of solid food as well, and throwing the bones, the shards, the broken tools, etc., into the newly dug ditches, which were then covered over again, only to be reopened another 10 years or so later. It seems likely that these sites of recurring public ceremony served as the foci for larger groups. Shall we call them peoples? Shall we call them tribes? Which were composed of several long barrow communities, sometimes several dozen. As such, the causewayed camps mark the centers of distinctive Neolithic territories that are evolving as the Windmill Hill culture goes on. The next step is the henge, but I'll save that for our next lecture.